Thanks everyone for joining us for, I think this is our second installment of the term, is that right? Second installment of the London Aesthetics Forum. And thank you to Senate House for hosting and giving us tech support and all that nice stuff. And to the British Society of Aesthetics for funding these events. It's my pleasure to welcome Karen Simichek here today from the University of Warwick. And she'll be talking to us about embodying words, the ethics of voice in performing poetry. Before I turn it over to her, I'll just mention that we'll roughly an hour for a talk, but with the Q&A, we're going to end today at about 1:45, 2:50, just because we've got a tight schedule. So I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for coming along. I hope it's a nice experience being able to do this in person. It's kind of scary for me, not having really seen this many people for quite a long time. Hey. So, one thing you'll note about my talk is, with it being about poetry, normally I end up having to read bits of poems as part of my paper. However, given the nature of this particular topic, I'm not going to do that. And you'll understand why as this goes on, and it's partly because I'm trying to draw attention to a particular kind of sensitivity around whose voice is giving voice to a particular poem. So this is just an extract from an Audre Lorde poem. I know that's probably going to be really irritating for the podcast that I'm not going to read it aloud, but people can look this up. It's an extract from A Litany of Survivor by Audre Lorde. It's a fantastic poem and it's really worth reading. Anyway, let's move on. So this paper is based on a chapter from my forthcoming book, Philosophy of Lyric Voice. So I wanted to just start by telling you a little bit about the context for the paper, a little bit about what I'm actually trying to argue in the book, so that you can get a sense of where this fits in and why I've been thinking about this particular issue. So the main argument of the book positions poetry as an inherently social art form. The use of voice and coming together of voice in poetry, so the idea of voice here is it's not just that stylistic aspect of voice that you might think of in terms, you know, so if somebody was saying in a creative writing class, find your voice, often what they mean by that is find your style, your artistic style. What I'm actually getting at is something more fundamental. So a big part of the book is devoted to discussing uniqueness of voice. And by uniqueness of voice, what that means is the particular way in which an individual speaks. So the words that they use, that come naturally to them, the sort of examples that they might draw on, these sort of images that they might think are appropriate for whatever it is they're talking about, the grammar that they use, all of these things have actually been shaped by the way that person thinks and feels, which actually is a product of their history. So I don't really want to get too much into these particular claims, but this is partly the grounding of the claims that I will be making in this paper to do with the significance of the embodied voice and why the body is relevant to how you interpret a poem, what it's actually doing, how it actually functions. And so just to say a little bit more about uniqueness of voice, it's actually a product of all of our interactions. So the way I speak, the way I think and feel is partly a product of other people that I've interacted with through my life. So one of the, I guess, central things in one's life is going to secondary school or high school. That kind of desire to fit in with other people around you, start to develop a shared kind of language that sticks with you for life. It's the trace of Brummie in my own accent there that comes from that particular history. So it's partly in virtue of that I think poetry becomes a social art form. It's an interaction of voices. In reading, it's that interaction of the reader and poet. In the performance, and this is what I'm going to be focusing on today, it's poet and audience. And audience is then a social thing because it's more than one of you. So the use of voice and coming together of voice in poetry forms a foundation of association, whether on the page or in performance. The experience of being brought into relationship with one another through poetic voice is not significant for its effective is not only significant for its effective power, but also for its enhancement of our appreciation of interpersonal concepts. So this is the big claim in the book about cognitivism. I think what poetry can do is actually contribute to a development of understanding of what I term as interpersonal concepts. These concepts are just things like loss, loneliness, togetherness, community. It's concepts that are about social life, are about either a lack of connection or connection to others. And I think that we can only fully appreciate what these concepts mean by thinking of those connections or lack of connection. So in the case of loss and loneliness, that's obviously to do with a lack. Togetherness, community, those sorts of concepts are to do with connection. So it's just as simple as that. So that's all I really mean by interpersonal concepts. And I think that these are concepts that can't be understood from a singular individual perspective, but only in relation to others. That's with awareness of our coexistence with others. So such a position of relationality, so that's relationality in the sense of, say, a poem uses the first person and the second person, so that's a relationship that's developed in I and you. It's that kind of thing that I mean here. Such a position of relationality can only be appreciated through actively seeking connection to others. So both writing and reading or hearing, poetry involves the seeking of connection with others. Poet to reader or audience, reader to audience to poet. And can therefore support development of understanding of these sorts of concepts. So again, that's a big claim that's lurking in the background here that I'm not going to defend here. So throughout the book, I've been very careful to provide a positive account of voice in poetry with the assumption that all voices have equal potential to be heard. And so this chapter comes towards the end of the book with the acknowledgement that unfortunately this is an ideal that's not reflected in society. There are many who find themselves members of unjustly marginalised groups, whether due to ableism, sexism, heteronormativity, racism, etc., and consequently experience additional barriers to having their voices heard and acknowledged. Furthermore, the argument of the book is to make the case for a particular kind of contribution to understanding of concepts, as I've just outlined, provided through engagement with works of poetry. So this is now bringing to the concern of this paper. To fail to hear voices within the context, within that context, means denying individuals their epistemic contribution and therefore perpetuating harm. It's important to be sensitive to power dynamics within society when engaging with poetry to ensure that poetry enables expression rather than hindering it. So what I want to argue in this paper is not only can poetry help counter oppression by enabling one to find their voice through poetry, but the experience of engaging with poetry cultivates intellectual and affective virtues of listening and seeking connection that are essential to hearing the voices of others. Poetry can aid reparation when poet and reader or audience are brought into relationship through the poetic work. The experience of poetry in reception, whether through forms of reading or in performance, acts as a response to silencing of unjustly marginalised people. Poetry can disrupt silencing by carving out space to be heard, placing readers or audiences in a relationship to the unknown and the unknowable, partly through a kind of connection whilst also acknowledging self-other differentiation. So there's always that separation of individuals, even though we might find something to share or overlap between, and therefore subverting power dynamics in society that underwrite their marginalisation. That unjustly marginalised people experience silencing has been much discussed in feminist philosophy. So, for instance, we've got Jennifer Hornsby, who I've quoted here, who argues that for some, their use of language fails in doing what they intend to as a consequence of the audience failing in their willingness and ability to recognise the intention of the speaker and responding appropriately to what was said. So these are her words. The silenced person is someone who literally cannot do with speech what she might have wanted to, whether because the language does not let her, which is termed ineffability, or because a certain kind of communication is not possible, which she labels inaudibility. What's needed, according to Hornsby, is reciprocity between speaker and listener. So this is her again. When there is reciprocity among people, they recognise one another's speech as it's meant to be taken. An audience who participates reciprocally does not merely understand the speaker's words, but also, in taking the words as they are meant to be taken, satisfies a condition for the speakers having done the communicative thing that she intended. So one of the things that I'm, the way I'm going to try and use this is to say that when a poet is delivering a poem, part of what's going on is some kind of communicative act. So that's why this is relevant. So another way of looking at this is to say that the speaker intends to communicate something with their words, but for communication, that's a using of language, trying to do something with language, for that to be successful requires an audience to recognise what was said, understand it, and respond appropriately to it. So the idea of responding there is kind of a marker of whether understanding has actually taken place. Being heard is not something that's in the control of the individual speaking. It requires an effort on part of the intended listener. The speaker needs the listener to be making some kind of effort to hear her. Consequently, to speak and to be heard is relational. It involves mutual recognition and reciprocity. And simply put by Christy Dotson, to communicate, we all need an audience willing and capable of hearing us. Although one might argue that poetry can help individuals respond to ineffability by allowing the poet to open up language and subvert everyday meaning, my concern is with reception and engagement with poetry on the page and in performance. But what I'm going to focus on here is just the performance side of things. Therefore, I will focus discussion on how poetry might serve to counter or mitigate inaudibility, since this will show a role for poetry in cultivating virtues in readers and audiences that help the unjustly marginalised be heard. The response to inaudibility is the relationality of poetry. So Sherry Irvin, she's talking about page poetry here, but I just wanted to borrow something that she'd said. She says, when members of a subordinated group attempt to capture their own experiences, they may feel a greater need for poetry that breaks open language in order to forge new semantic networks, or to act directly on the reader to produce an experience rather than merely describing one. The need to break open language places pressure on the reader and the audience in terms of their willingness and ability to hear non-conventional uses of language. To express or communicate such experience and be heard depends on the audience or the reader accepting effective completeness of the work, despite not being able to settle completely the meaning of the work. All that's required for understanding is the felt grasp, so it's that experience that's produced for the audience or reader that opens up possibilities of meaning rather than being reduced to description. So what I want to argue is that poetry and performance has the power to enhance the speaker-listener dynamic. It helps us to learn to listen better as members of an audience, but also as readers. Crucially, through performance, we become aware of the significance of the embodiment of words in meaning-making and expression. This is not only important for aesthetic appreciation of the work, but is ethically significant. So my aim, in short, is to try and highlight two ethical issues in performance and reception of poetry. The first is to identify a kind of aesthetic flaw that comes about from separating the words of a poem from the embodied voice. Since that reduces aesthetic appreciation, and as I will show through one particular example, that leads to a moral flaw. The second kind of ethical issue arises when we consider this separation of words and embodied voice in the context of the cultural appropriation debate. Separating words from the embodied voice of the poet performer can amount to a harm in itself. So that's going to be the bigger of the two claims that I'm going to make. So the first one looks like it's very specific to this one example, but from that I'm going to use that as a way of opening up this idea of appropriation as causing harm. So then any time that you're separating the words of a poem from a poet who's unjustly marginalised, you're going to be doing some kind of harm. So it's kind of a big and controversial claim, but we'll see if I take you with me on this. So words are not merely embodied, but require an audience to make the connection between words, voice and body. As David Davies argues, so these are his words, the performer differs from the mere agent whose behaviour is subject to evaluation, in that she intends for her actions to be appreciated and evaluated, and thus is consciously guided in what she does by the expected eye or ear of an intended qualified audience. In order to be in a position to appreciate and evaluate the work, the poetry audience must contextualise the words of the poem as embodied, as centred in and related to the body of the performer. Now, there's very few big works that have been written about performance poetry, but Julia Novak is one of the people that has actually done this work. She's got a book called Live Poetry, and in that she writes, "The physical co-presence of poet and audience in a live poetry performance allows for a range of other sense perceptions, facial expression, bodily communication, audience interaction, that considerably impact on the impression the audience has of the performance and thus on the meaning-making process." So she's really just getting at the idea that there's both an audio text, so the words of the poem, but she has this idea that there's a corresponding body text. And those two things together are the relevant things in the kind of meaning-making function of the poem. And it's through the experience of poetry and performance that we become aware of mutual vulnerability in reading poetry written by someone other than oneself. That is, feelings of shareability and connection alongside openness and fluidity of meaning. Meaning making is a shared practice. It happens together as a joint project rather than being singular, fixed and individually owned. So even the poet doesn't have that kind of full ownership. In this way, the byproduct of the argument is going to be another controversial claim, that poetry and performance ought to be central to our experiences of engaging with poetry more generally. One cannot fully appreciate page poetry without also having the experience of engaging with poetry and performance. I don't mean that the only way to appreciate any individual poem is to have heard it performed. It's more as a thing to understand poetry as an art form. Part of what you need to have engaged with is poetry and performance. So what the body contributes to meaning making is a grounding of the perspective of the poem. So that's a particular way of thinking and feeling, or patterns of value that's presented by the poem. Those ways, images, feelings, thoughts, words, connotations, associations, whatever, the way they come together as a unified whole. That is just a perspective. It's a framing of the subject that it's about. That's all I mean by that. It's the performer's body that provides the evidence, and these are now words from a paper by Hannah Kim and John Gibson on the lyric eye. And they're concerned with this idea of how does the lyric eye function. And they say that what's always needed is sufficient subjective life. We need to find this kind of evidence of a sufficient subjective life such that we can justify our ascription of psychological and expressive predicates to it. We want to say that this poem expresses a feeling of, say, loss or grief or something, but then there's a sense of, well, it's weird if you say that the poem feels that. So what they've done is they talk about how that might be representative of a type of experience. Others might want to posit some kind of character. But what I'm saying is, in the poetry performance, when you're thinking of that performative context, it's just straightforward. Well, I assume that's a human being in front of me. Like, you know, you might have thoughts about this paper and make assumptions that I'm something with sufficient subjective life, hopefully. Additionally, as highlighted by Peter Middleton, the body also signals agency and action. The words of the poem are doing something to or for the audience. So this is Peter Middleton. "These words arise out of the speaker whose bodily presence and identity is their warrant, and whose delivery shows what it means to think and say these words and ideas. Indeed, shows what it means to live them for at least the moment of their delivery. The presence of a speaker is a reminder that the words are temporarily invoked from an individual with a particular point of view, a particular body, a particular experience and history." So the use of first person, for instance, invokes the real world body on stage and acts as a call to attention to that body, as representative of their perspective and agency, not as reduced to some aspect of their identity.
The way that the poet performer thinks and feels is represented by the body. It's an embodiment of their perspective. So the things that he was talking about, that particular point of view, that way of thinking and feeling, that way of bringing this set of things together that makes sense to at least someone. In the case of an actor, the body is used as a prop in a world of make-believe, even where after a performance the audience are left wondering to what degree the performance was autobiographical. That's not really a question that tends to arise in the context of performance poetry, because the body plays a different kind of role. So to illustrate this, I just want to mention this example of Claire Collinson's award-winning poetry performance, Truth is Beauty. So it's kind of a work of poetry, but it's also not strictly poetry. It's also, well, I don't know what you call it, it's just a performance. She stages her a monologue, which she describes as her single-breasted monologue, as part of a live drawing class. And she's had the experience of undergoing a mastectomy as part of her own treatment for breast cancer. So in advertising her performance, Collinson comments, "Why are thousands of women like me so hidden? What anxieties do we share as a society where disguise is regarded as important as treatment? How can women make informed treatment choices when there is so little representation of us within mainstream culture?" So the point of her performance is to attempt to disrupt mainstream culture and challenge those dominant views of the female body by using the performance space as a place to be heard and be seen. It's quite clear that her body in that context is not just not being used as a prop in a game of make-believe. It doesn't have that kind of fictional construct that a dramatic monologue might have, for instance. It's making her body present, or as she, I think, puts it at one point, it makes the invisible visible. The need to see the use of words in poetry as connected to embodied knowledge has a consequence for how we read poetry and how poetry is performed when written by those who have experienced oppression, particularly where what the poet intends to communicate relates to their embodied knowledge. For instance, poet Katie Ailes comments, "If a man were to perform my poems, Swallow or Flesh, which concern issues specific to the experience of having a female body, the embodied performance would obviously contradict the text of the poem, and indeed would probably come across as a cruel parody undermining the central message of these poems." But this issue also showed up in the controversy over the proposed Dutch translation of Amanda Gorman's The Hill We Climb. That was the poem that she performed at Joe Biden's presidential inauguration. And it was suggested, I think she even put forward the suggestion that the person that would do the translation would be Marieke Lucas Richneveld. But, so despite the fact that the poet herself said, oh yes, that would be a great choice, this was met with a backlash, because it was taken that what was important to the poem was the embodied knowledge of what it's like to be a young black woman living in the US. So trying to get clear on how the body is relevant, we can consider cases in which the body of the poet is disconnected from the work in a re-performance or revoicing of that work. So this issue can be framed by a set of questions. So when is it appropriate or inappropriate, or to use more moral language, when is it permissible or impermissible to perform the work of another? What role does the body of the performer play in meaning-making and interpretation by the audience in the performance space? What happens when we speak the words of another, where meaning-making is shaped not only by word meaning, but also by features associated with the voice and body delivering those words? So just to give you a sense that this is a live issue, there's all sorts of times where people revoice words of poetry. You go to a wedding, go to a funeral, you hear it there. Go into a lot of schools in the UK and the US, and you're also going to hear school children being given poems that they've not chosen themselves and being told to perform them out loud. I think Michael Gove was particularly keen on students, really young people, learning these things by heart, because apparently that was a really good part of his own education. It's turned out well, but anyway. So just to be clear, I'm not talking about issues of plagiarism. As I've already suggested, this idea of revoicing works of poetry, there's no claim to authorship when a school child stands up and recites a poem, that's what we take it to be. They're not saying, I wrote this, and waiting to be caught out by that claim. That's not what's going on. It's just thought that there's a... This is certainly how it's got into the school curriculum. There is a good that comes from hearing poetry read aloud. Now, that's a sentiment I want to get behind from what I've said already, that hearing works performed is an important thing, but there's a caveat that in some cases there's going to be a restriction on how that gets performed. Okay, so let's move on to the central example. Now, this example is going to strike you as very... sort of very helpful for my project because it fits so well with what it is that I'm trying to say here. But at the same time, it will probably strike you as, and that's, how often does that kind of thing come about? That doesn't seem very typical of poetry. But just bear with me, because as I say, I'm going to try and make some general claims off the back of this. The fact that this happens, I still think is worth talking about. So this is a poem called Skinhead by Patricia Smith. And this is going to help make clear the relationship of the embodied performance and the meaning-making experience of hearing the poem in performance. It's going to help bring that into sharp focus. So the first thing to note is that this is a persona poem. So the voice... So there's a fictionalized voice within the poem. And what Patricia Smith has done is she's given voice to a fictional white supremacist. So when performed by Smith herself, there's a relationship of tension and critique that's established between the voice of the persona and her voice as the poet performer. As a black American woman, Smith's voicing of a fictional white supremacist transforms the words spoken. The relationality of the two voices, so Smith's as performer and the white supremacist poetic persona, creates an anti-racist poem that seeks to understand through embodying another's voice how such racism can exist and flourish in American society. Skinhead demands that the audience acknowledge the words of the poem, the persona represented by the words, and the embodiment of those words. To fail to appreciate the role of the body here is to miss something very significant about the work and how it works, how it functions. The presentation becomes a problem for the audience to deal with in terms of that conflict and intimacy between the voice of the white supremacist and Patricia Smith as a black American woman. So I just want to give you a sense of, I'm not going to show you the entire poem, I'm just going to give you a brief bit of it. So hopefully I'm not going to show you all of it. Come on. Oh, I think it's loading, that's the problem. It might be that you have to watch all of it. Hope that's okay. It's only about 3 minutes.
They call me Skinhead, and I got my own unit. It is knife scrawled across my back in sore, jagged letters. It is in the way my eyes snap away from the obvious. I sit in my dim matchbox on the edge of a bed tousled with my ragged smell, slide razors across my hair, count how many ways I can bring blood closer to the surface of my skin. These are the duties of the righteous, the ways of the anointed. The face that moves in my mirror is huge and pockmarked, apple-cheeked, scraped pink and brilliant. I am filled with my own spit. 2 years ago, a machine that slices leather sucked in my hand and held it, whacking off 3 fingers at the root. I didn't feel nothing until I looked down and saw them on the floor next to my boot heel, and I ain't worked since then. I sit here and watch niggers take over my TV set, walking like kings up and down the sidewalks in my head. My shoulders tell me that ain't right, so I move out into the sun, where my beauty makes them lower their heads. I was born to make things right. It's easy now to bend my big body into shadows, to move from a place where there was nothing into the stark circle of a streetlight, the pipe raised up high over my head. It's a kick to watch their eyes get big, round and gleaming like cartoon jungle boys, just in that second before they know the pipe's gonna come down. And I got this thing I like to say, hey, listen to this, I like to say, hey nigga, hey Lincoln. Lincoln's been dead a long time. I get hard just listening to their skin burst. I was born to make things right. Then this reporter comes around. Seems I was a little sloppy kicking some fag's ass, and he opens up and screams about it. So this reporter finds me at home in bed. The TV flashes, licking my face clean. Same old shit. I ain't got no job. The colors and spics got them. Why not working? Look at my hand, asshole. No, I'm not part of no organized group. I'm just a white boy who loves this race, fighting for a pure country. Sometimes it's just me. Sometimes three. Sometimes 30. AIDS will take care of the faggots. Then it's gonna be white on black in the streets. Then there'll be 3 million. I tell him that. So he writes it up, and I come off looking like I'm some kind of goddamn freak, like I'm Hitler himself. I ain't that lucky, but I've got my own beauty. It's in my steel-toed boots, in the hard corners of my shaved head. I look in the mirror, and I hold up my mangled hand. Only the baby finger left. I know it's the wrong finger, but fuck you all anyway. I am riding the top rung of the perfect race, my face scraped pink and brilliant. I'm your baby, America. Your boy. Drunk on my own spit, I am goddamn fucking beautiful. And I was born and raised
so as I say, it's a really great example in terms of it really matters who it is that's voicing those words. She's clearly, there's no point in that where you could mistakenly think she's endorsing any of the things that she's saying. So it really matters, and you'll see why I'm emphasising this, because of something that happened. But anyway, we'll come to that. So there's a use of the second person towards the end of the poem there that kind of challenges the audience. There's also, I'm your baby, America, your boy. So there's that connecting back to the audience, making it something for them to think about. But there's also the use of the first person in those final words that collapses the two identities. Where she says, and I was born and raised right here. Both the white supremacist persona and Patricia Smith herself, which helps to reinforce the sentiment that that conflict present in her work is a product of a society that enables such white supremacism to develop. So she genuinely wants to understand, how does this happen? And how can she understand that? But it's obviously an ongoing, difficult thing to... I mean, it's uncomfortable listening to her performance, but that is part of what she's trying to do, is get people to engage with that uncomfortableness, because this is something that happens, and this is something that some people think, and we ought to deal with that uncomfortableness rather than hide it. In his book, Artistic Creation and Ethical Criticism, Ted Nanocelli draws a useful distinction between the attitudes and ideals expressed through a set of words and the action performed in giving voice to those words. In making his case, he gives the example of work songs. He argues, the ethical merit of the work songs is partly but not entirely a matter of the attitudes or ideals articulated in the lyrics. By singing the lyrics, one performs another action, in this case protesting unjust labour conditions, or in the case of hate speech, inciting violence. So it's not just the lyrics themselves, but the action an agent performed by voicing them that is ethically valuable. So in performing this poem, Smith is doing more than communicating what the words of the poem mean. I think actually this example is more complex than the kind of example of work songs, because Nanocelli's seeing a situation where someone endorses those words and does something with them, whereas in this case, there's not that endorsement of the words, but there is action. Through her embodied performance, she's then performing another action, namely one of critique. So it's a counter to the attitudes expressed by that white supremacist persona. And to fail to recognise the significance of her body in performance is to fail to see the poem as anti-racist, and therefore to fail to see the performance as ethically significant. To make the point more explicit, I want to bring in something that happened, the history to this poem. Susan Summers Willett, in her book about performance poetry, discusses what happens when Smith's poem was performed by another performance poet in the US, Taylor Malley, a white male, at an event to celebrate the work of Smith. So what he did, he thought this was one of her great works, to celebrate her achievement, I know what I'll do, I'll perform it, and to make matters worse, he actually copied her gestures as well. So he obviously got some sense that the embodied voice was important, but missed actually what was crucial. So this is what Susan Summers Willett says. Because Malley is visibly hailed as a white male himself, most of his audience could not readily recognise this voice as a persona and confuse the supremacist position with his own. And she comments that the performance was met with strong disapproval, as you would hope, including by those that recognised that the poetic persona was not his own, so those that understood his intentions. Such a reaction is evidence that Smith's embodiment of skinhead is just as much a performance of her own identity as a black woman as it is of her persona's identity and views. So in voicing the words of the poem, Malley performs a different action to that performed by Smith in her performance. At worst, we can see Malley's embodied voice endorsing the attitudes of the poetic persona. At best, it remains neutral. In either case, the failure to perform the action of critique renders his performance morally reprehensible. Smith's performance contrasts the attitudes expressed by the words of the poem with the attitudes expressed by her embodied, contextualised performance of those words. Taylor Malley performs Smith's poem in tribute to her, not realising that in doing so he was undermining the complex, effective relationship between audio text and body text, and reducing her poem to just words, thereby obscuring the contribution of the body to meaning-making by the audience. So in a way, he's legitimising just treating the poem as if it is just a set of words. So the same work performed by different people, that is, different embodied voices, resulted in performances that do something and mean something very different from one another. The words and gestures are the same, but voiced by different bodies with different identities. And I thought the writing of Bell Hooks was very relevant here, and where she comments on the nature of performance. She writes, so she's not talking about this case, she's just talking more generally about performance, but this seemed particularly apt here. In one context, performance can easily become an act of complicity. In the other, it can serve as critical intervention, as a rite of resistance. So we can see Malley's performance became an act of complicity and oppression, whereas Smith serves as critical intervention. The difference between the two performances is what they are each able to do with the words of the poem, that is, the action they perform through the performance of that poem. Malley's body fails to provide any tension with the words spoken, and consequently the action performed, albeit not intentioned, is one of endorsement of the words spoken. Okay. So I'm just going to skip ahead to the next section then. Because what I've tried to do so far is really make that first part of the argument that somehow that separation of body from words, although there is an ethical dimension to that, that's actually a result of Malley having done some kind of aesthetic damage to the work by severing that relationship, and that led to the moral problem. However, what I want to do now is say that there is just simply a moral problem in any kind of separation of poem from words when we're talking about them having been written by people who are from unjustly marginalised groups. So the example of Malley's performance of Smith's poem may seem like a rare and peculiar case that, although interesting, does not have much to tell us about other cases of revoicing poetry or the relevance of the relationship between the embodied performance and the words of the poem more generally. However, what I want to argue is that the body is not just relevant to the meaning-making experience of the poem, but that failure to appreciate the relationship between embodied voice and the words of the poem, such as Taylor Malley's failure to appreciate the significance of Smith's body to the performance of the work, can result in harm, which is not only relevant in performing, evaluating the performance, but also it has consequences for the act of reading. In making this case, I'm now going to bring in the debate on cultural appropriation, but I'm not so much interested in that, in the way that's been discussed in terms of culture. It's either culture or identity, and for me it's the identity part that's relevant. But it's a useful framework here. So I'm going to do, the reason for doing this is to argue that in cases where the poet is a marginalised speaker, failure to acknowledge the significance of their embodied voice, that's the action they perform in writing and performing the poem, in future performances and reception of the work, is to perpetuate oppression and cause harm. So, as we know, there's been a big debate about cultural appropriation, and I think it largely started with James Young, who identified three types of cultural appropriation. So he has the subject appropriation, when a work depicts members or objects of another culture; content appropriation, when an artist uses aesthetic features of another culture in the production of their work; and object appropriation, when a work is taken out of its cultural context. And I think now we have style appropriation as well. I want to add in an additional form of appropriation here, and that's what I'm terming appropriation of expression, which is found in the revoicing and reperforming of poetry. It's kind of the idea here is, oh, there's a set of words that I might be able to use to express something, but you're taking it out of some original context. You're removing it from its original voicing. So it arises from the fact that words of a poem necessarily relate to the body of the poet-performer who uses those words in an act of self-expression, and where that self-expression relates to their identity of a marginalised group in society. Although what is borrowed is not tied to culture as such, it is tied to identity. So returning to that example of Patricia Smith's performance of Skinhead and Taylor Mallie's revoicing, which I think the latter is an example of this appropriation of expression, Mallie's performance is not just bad in virtue of his seeming endorsement of the attitudes expressed by the poetic persona. I mean, obviously that is morally wrong in itself, but there's a further harm that's caused by his revoicing, which is to do with the way in which the words of Smith's poem are presented as separable from her body and identity as a black woman, which is central to the aesthetics of the work. Mallie's performance of Smith's poem is a case of appropriation of expression, and the performance is aesthetically defective in virtue of this twofold moral harm caused by revoicing the poem. So in discussions of cultural appropriation, the moral harm is thought to be due to power imbalances in society where a vulnerable group's culture is appropriated by a dominant oppressive group. Although I know that the intimacy account gives a different analysis, so I'm just going with that oppressive account. In cases of appropriation of expression, the moral harm is also due to power imbalances where the words of an unjustly marginalised voice is appropriated by a dominant voice, thereby doing harm to the individual who originally aimed to use their words to make meaning and make an epistemic contribution. That's why I mentioned my cognitivist claims at the beginning. By removing certain significant contextual features, one's epistemic contribution is undermined due to the privilege and dominance of the one appropriating those words. So Eric Mathers writes, when a particular case is most saliently understood as one of silencing, exploitation, misrepresentation or offence, what ultimately makes particular instances of cultural appropriation wrongful, and thus what grounds objections to them, is the way in which they manifest and or exacerbate inequality and marginalisation. And that's what he calls the oppression account of cultural appropriation. Whether or not that's the right way of characterising cultural appropriation, that's not really my issue here, but it's a useful framework for understanding what might be wrong in revoicing particular works of poetry. The problem with revoicing or neglecting the embodied voice in the reception of poetry is that it potentially contributes to the silencing of the voice of the poet by divorcing the action of communication or expression from the words of the poem, thereby denying recognition of the poet as a knower. As Mathers writes, what makes this wrongful is when such silencing serves to exacerbate inequality and marginalisation. Although I've argued that the embodied performance is always significant, or at least, you know, that's what I've been gesturing at, failure to recognise that significance will not always amount to harm, but may just amount to failure to fully appreciate the work aesthetically, that there's a layer of meaning that's missing. The moral significance will hinge on contingent features of society and the situatedness of the speaker, poet, performer, and the relative dominance and privilege of the audience reader. So I'm trying to leave aside the specifics of that example that I've mentioned, and to talk more generally, this is when this is going to count. Furthermore, the poetry performance offers a space for those unjustly marginalised in society to be heard and seen and acknowledged as knowers, and this is what's potentially at stake in neglect of embodied voice and appreciation of poetry. So revoicing a poem and appropriating expression not only potentially changes the meaning of the work, but denies the epistemic contribution made. Appropriation of expression may therefore be an example of what Emmeline Davis, in a 2018 paper in Ethics, calls epistemic appropriation. She writes, "The harm of epistemic appropriation is twofold. First, while epistemic resources developed within the margins gain intercommunal uptake, those resources are overtly detached from the marginalised knowers responsible for their production." And she calls this epistemic detachment. So revoicing of certain works of poetry by certain poets will cause such epistemic detachment. Embodied knowledge that was intended to be expressed through the performance of the work is detached from the body of the poet-performer. And she goes on to write, so I'm applying what she says to the poetry context, she doesn't talk about poetry herself. She says, when epistemic detachment occurs, the intercommunal pool is expanded to incorporate new epistemic resources, so concepts, interpretations, stories and meanings. But the participatory role of marginalised contributors in the process of knowledge production is obscured. So if I apply this to the case of poetry, we can see how detaching the words of the poem from the context of the body and the performance of identity and attaching to a new body and context the alter meaning of the work, concepts evoked an interpretation. So you might think that something of their contribution remains, but there's also a lot that's missing. And Davies characterises the second harm as follows. So she calls this epistemic misdirection, and she says it occurs when epistemic resources developed within but detached from the margins are utilised in dominant discourses in ways that disproportionately benefit the powerful. That's to say, the benefits associated with the epistemic contributions of the marginalised are misdirected towards the comparatively privileged. By revoicing, damage is done to the notion of authenticity in performance of poetry, since the body is forgotten in the appreciation and evaluation of poetry. It's the poet performer's body that grounds the words of the poem in showing that it mean what. So this is to go back to Peter Middleton. What it means to live them, to think and feel them for at least this moment of delivery. The body provides the reference point. That's the coming together of thoughts and feelings. To give the work a different embodied delivery is to change the reference point for those thoughts and feelings expressed by the words and potentially change the action performed by those words. In the case of Malley's revoicing of Smith's poem, the work becomes lesser for having been re-performed. But this would also be the case for works such as Claire Collinson's Truth is Beauty and her desire to make visible the invisible. The idea of misdirection in this context is a case of separating the body from embodied knowledge by the audience, whereas we might see the first harms being committed by the one doing the revoicing. As Davies argues, in such cases, the harm is not a result of denying members of marginalised groups the ability to contribute knowledge, but in recognising them as knowers and as having made that epistemic contribution. She writes, targets of epistemic appropriation are not prevented from putting knowledge into the public domain. Rather, they are prevented from being recognised as having put that knowledge into the public domain. That the members of marginalised groups are never acknowledged as contributors is essential to the perpetuation of their epistemic marginalisation. Failure to have one's contribution recognised is to render one's speech disempowered, for one loses the power to be seen and heard in the context of that use of language. The poet's role in communicating through their poem is significantly diminished. So, in a way, I feel that by retelling you the story of Taylor Malley's re-performance of Smith, there's a sense in which I've actually done further harm to her poem, because it's hard to, once you hear the story, it's hard to watch her performance without also thinking about that happened as well. So it's a sense that a kind of re-performance can take the original. Engaging with poetry is not enough to guarantee that the voice of unjustly marginalised poets are heard. The reader and audience of poetry must develop a sensitivity and awareness of the contribution of the embodied voice to meaning-making of the work. This ought to extend beyond poetry that straightforwardly references the body to poetry written about any subject, since it's the poet's embodied voice that ultimately shapes the perspective of the poem. Limiting another's epistemic contribution to only knowledge that directly relates to certain characteristics of their body is just as much a problem as a complete denial of voice for perpetuating oppression. So the reason for bringing this up is from something that Darren McGarvey, aka Lockie, wrote in his book Poverty Safari. So this is what he wrote. "The second I wandered off that topic, people started shuffling their papers and things got awkward. It seemed my criticism was often deemed not to be constructive enough. Despite the constant talk of empowerment and giving voice to the voiceless, it was obvious many of these people were only interested in my thoughts if they were about my experiences as a poor person. It was assumed that people like me had very little insight on anything else." So given part of my context here is to do with people making an epistemic contribution through poetry, trying to communicate something, trying to do something with words, then it would seem bad if the only times that we're interested in their embodied performance and recognising them as knowers is when we think, oh, well, that's a poem. So in the case of Smith, oh, that's a poem about racism, so then it matters. But in these other cases, it doesn't, because in a way that's to do another kind of harm of still saying, okay, you can be a knower of that kind of stuff, but you can't be a knower of that kind of stuff. So the epistemic contribution is connected to that individual's perspective, to their patterns of thoughts and feelings that configure value, that are informed by, but not limited or reduced to, embodied experience. In the context of the poetry performance, it is the failure to recognise the contribution of the body in performance that causes harm, in that it denies recognition of the poet performer as having made that contribution and may limit what the poet is able to do with their words. For the words have shifted in meaning in virtue of that separation of words and embodied voice. Furthermore, this may in some cases have the consequence of excluding or diminishing the role of people from marginalised groups from developing communal understanding of interpersonal concepts for which we need to appreciate individual experience and how we relate to one another. To deny certain voices the ability to contribute to such development of understanding is to perpetuate oppression and ultimately weaken appreciation of such concepts. Okay, thank you.